Welcome to another exciting episode of NID's Knowledge, this one being Real Space Strategy Edition. This podcast is produced by the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will inform you about the latest in space strategy and its importance to our national defense. Well, today is a very special episode for me, as my guest is one of my former students who has written a great paper that was published in the Journal of Policy and Strategy that I personally think is very important and informative for everyone listening, not just for the policy leaders in Washington, D.C. Dr. Kathleen C. Ellis, known as Casey to me, was one of my students when I all too briefly taught a course on space policy and strategy at Missouri State University's Graduate Department of Defense and Strategic Studies a few years back. And I have to say, I think she was one of my best students. I'm not just saying that because you're on the podcast, but I think you were, if not my best student, you were one of the best students, as I think you will see, folks, with this strategically important topic that she wrote about, which is China's Beidou Positioning, Navigation, and Timing Constellation. So welcome, Casey. Good to see you, and happy to have you with us.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. And kudos to you for providing a platform for discussing national security topics as they relate to the space domain.
Yeah, no problem. It's one of the things I really enjoy doing. So let's start at the beginning for our listeners to give them some foundations on the discussion. This paper that you wrote initially in the class and then published later on in a modified form covers linkages between two major Chinese efforts, the Beidou Constellation and the Belt and Road Initiative. Could you give our listeners a quick summary of both of these and why you chose to write about the nexus between the two?
Sure. And I do want to preface my comments by emphasizing that I speak in my own personal capacity, not on behalf of the Department of Defense or any other entity or organization other than myself. But to answer your question, Chris, the Beidou system is China's own independent navigation satellite system, or what we call a positioning, navigation, and timing, or PNT system. So like the United States Global Positioning System, or GPS, which we're all familiar with, Beidou is a global system. It's younger than GPS. GPS stems from a program that the United States began in the 1960s, whereas China began developing Beidou in 1994, launched its first experimental satellites in 2000. Fast forward to 2020, and China placed its final satellite into orbit to complete global coverage. So Beidou is actually, it's a larger constellation than GPS in terms of satellite numbers and also offers greater accuracy than GPS in some regions of the world. So this intrigued me that China was completing its own independent global system. There are only four global PNT systems in existence, GPS, Russia's GLONASS system, and then the European Union's Galileo system. So China's Beidou system makes the fourth global system. And there are interesting implications for commercial and technological competition with China's joining of the global PNT arena. But what really intrigued me was discovering how China's Beidou system relates to its Belt and Road Initiative. China's ambitious Belt and Road Initiative, which I think most of us have heard of or are familiar with, is an expansive technology-powered version of China's ancient Silk Road. So the BRI aims to create economic and political connections and partnerships around the world through Chinese investment in massive infrastructure projects. Think ports and roads and railways. And since its start in 2013, China has attracted interest in the BRI from over 140 countries and has gained strategic footholds through that system, especially in developing countries across Asia, Africa, and South America. Now, many analysts suspect that the BRI is really an ambitious attempt by Beijing to cultivate leverage, coercive leverage over much of the developing world and to secure access to strategic locations for its economic and military objectives. and to compromise the sovereignty of the host countries and their political institutions. And so two major interconnected substrands of the BRI are what are called the Digital Silk Road and the Space Silk Road. Mm-hmm. And these constructs are somewhat nebulous, but Beijing uses these Silk Road names to characterize its vision for digitally connecting its BRI members globally with satellite navigation infrastructure, as well as the 5G cellular network and terrestrial and submarine data cables and data storage centers. So I see the Beidou PNT system as really the grand web that is poised to pull all of the BRI members under a single digital umbrella that's ultimately controlled by the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, so I know, but if we back up a minute, so the United States, early in the post-Cold War period, made the decision to open up GPS as a, quote, global utility for all the world to use commercially, civilly, whatever. Even some militaries have been using the basic frequencies and stuff because they got rid of what's called selective availability, which allows us to turn off certain things. And so as other nations began to build their own systems, such as the ones you mentioned before, Galileo, GLONASS, and now the Beidou, the official policy of the U.S. has been the more the merrier. Let's work together. Let's do this for the benefit of everybody. And there was really no sense of competition or threat in the mindset with regards to, you know, who's going to be the lead PNT provider for the world. And even this is up to even just a couple of years ago when I talked to some folks who were on the Space Council and some other things. I'm like, hey, what do you think about this? And they're like, oh, this is great. And I'm thinking, have you not heard of this BRI stuff that that you mentioned? So as time went on, as you know, through the 90s, it became more and more connected, interconnected into our society, our critical infrastructure, as well as our Western allies in Europe became more and more integrated to GPS timing and navigation. So if you could, I know you had a good section on the paper in this too, but if you could give us a quick rundown on why U.S. policy leaders thought that this was a good idea to have sort of a interconnected, internationalized PNT, and if this was always the view of U.S. policy.
Yeah, so the opening of GPS occurred under President Ronald Reagan. So GPS was developed originally as a U.S. military capability. In 1983, which was in the depths of the Cold War, the Soviet Union shot down a commercial airliner, a Korean Airlines flight, that had originated in its travel from the United States and had unknowingly strayed into Soviet airspace. So President Reagan, I think, wanted to show the United States technological prowess, but also its humanitarian values by making GPS signals available for international civilian use. So when GPS became fully operational and global, the U.S. made it available free of charge to anyone with a receiver. And this really set the pattern, I think, of viewing PNT capabilities as a global utility or a global commons. And subsequent U.S. presidents continued this policy of openness, especially as the U.S. economy benefited from GPS. Civilian applications of GPS rose exponentially. And because the United States was, for a long period of time, the only provider of such technology and such capability globally, this was a boon to the U.S. economy. And competition wasn't a foremost consideration. So overall, over time, U.S. policy began to become more oriented to its civilian and commercial customer base rather than solely its military base. In the 1990s, President Clinton accelerated this trend as he sought to pivot the U.S. away from its Cold War posture to realize that peace dividend and to focus on energizing America's technology base in order to grow and integrate the American economy into the global economy. And remember, this was the era of the internet. The information revolution was taking off. And in harmony with this emphasis, the Clinton administration spoke of GPS as a global information utility. And that term was put into official use. And that policy attitude and posture has really endured to the present day.
Okay. So I want to combine two questions here as a jumping off from that. So you mentioned all the benefits, the commercial benefits, and everything that we were trying to push with our GPS being open, not just the humanitarian, but the commercial, like you said. And so to combine two questions here, why did China then decide to build their own system and not use the GPS system? And why now would you call it the constellation of vassalage, as you called it in the paper?
So there were two significant galvanizing events behind China's decision to pursue Beidou. One was the 1991 Persian Gulf War, when the United States showed the world its ability to project immense and precise military power in the invasion of Iraq. And Beijing took note and recognized, I think, that they were witnessing a revolution in military affairs. Second, and more personally painful for Beijing, was the 1995-1996 Taiwan Strait crisis, during which the Chinese military temporarily lost the ability to guide and track its own missiles because the system was dependent on GPS. It's commonly believed that the U.S. military selectively denied China GPS coverage during that time. And China describes this incident as a humiliation. They realized that if their military was to be effective or to support Beijing's political goals at all in the future, they were going to need an indigenous sovereign PNT capability. As I mentioned earlier, Beidou, it's now a global system. I mentioned that it's poised to connect the Belt and Road Initiative countries horizontally. But let me add to that, as we start talking about this idea of vassalage, that Beidou can also connect BRI members to Beijing vertically as well. Mm-hmm. So in vertical terms, China's vision for the Digital Silk Road appears to be to connect all sectors of society with Chinese digital infrastructure. And the best representative concept here is what we call smart cities. So smart cities are those urban digital ecosystems characterized by the integrated application of network technology. So think of the Internet of Things, the 5G network, connecting society purportedly in the interest of providing convenient, efficient civic and commercial services in an urban context. The sobering implication is that as Beidou encircles the developing world through the Belt and Road Initiative and smart city pilots, of which there are many Chinese pilots, Beijing will be increasingly poised to collect data and control movement and to exert leverage over great swaths of the globe, particularly as society becomes more dependent on PNT capabilities. So what this means is that Beidou-covered areas will be increasingly beholden to a kind of hostage diplomacy, potentially. Mm-hmm. Areas that are dependent on Beijing's digital infrastructure for the health of their economic and information ecosystems will be vulnerable to pressure or extortion from Beijing to support China's interests and policies on Taiwan, Xinjiang, Hong Kong, and other delicate matters, the South China Sea. So not only is there a danger that much of the world will become technologically dependent on and beholden to Beijing in that way, but the other side of this is that the United States is poised to lose the influence and leverage that it has through GPS and its own technology and economic heft. So leveraging Beidou through the space and digital Silk Road efforts, including the Smart City Initiative, I just see China casting its Belt and Road Initiative net broadly and deeply and securing valuable technological footholds around the world, which further positions itself to reorient economic and geopolitical power in Asia and the developing world and beyond from the United States to China.
Yeah, well, I'll just mention for folks who are listening who may not know a lot about Chinese history is the terms that the Chinese are using, such as, and of course you use vassalage, which is also a nod toward Chinese history, is, of course you mentioned the Silk Roads, which were their big trade routes and things of that sort, but at the same time, a vassalage system was something that was around back during all the dynasties, pre-communism and pre-Western engagement, when the Chinese believed they were the center of the universe, literally, and that they were the top dogs, if you will, internationally, and that all these countries, including the Western countries that initially started coming at that time for trade, were coming because they were superior culturally and politically and everything else. And so they had this vassalage system where all these tributaries, as they were called, these smaller countries around Asia and other places would come and provide gifts and things of that sort. And as a result, they would use that as the way to build up their power and to exert influence. And then the other thing I'll mention to folks listening is that if you haven't looked at a map of the Belt and Road Initiative, it's essentially encircling the United States' traditional spheres of influence. It's in Asia, it's in Africa, it's in the Indian Ocean area, it's in Oceania, it's even starting to creep into South America and Central America. And so this is not just something that's just a regional thing. This is something that, as you mentioned, is global, and their reach is becoming even more so. And the fact that they can pretty much control, whether they turn the lights on or a power plant operates or not because they turn off the timing signal, it's kind of similar to how the Russians leverage oil refineries and pipelines. If they want to turn off the gas in the wintertime to punish Eastern or Western Europe for doing something they don't like, they can do that as long as they're reliant on Russian oil. And in the case of China here, you've got a situation where pretty much all major infrastructure with these smart cities, so-called, are integrated into either timing or navigation signals, depending on which sector you're talking about. And so, I mean, that this ought to be fairly straightforward to folks listening, but some still may be asking, okay, big deal. Why do we care what China does with their space systems and their Belt and Road efforts and other nations of the world? I mean, that's none of our business. Why should the public, Casey, take this seriously? And what are the implications for the United States and our allies because of this specific constellation and Space Silk Road?
It's an important question to ask, Chris, and I'll just follow the thread that you were just tracing, which is we have to remember that China's approach to foreign policy, Beijing's approach to foreign policy, is very different from the United States. So the Chinese Communist Party is very authoritarian, hierarchical. Its foreign policy seeks transactional relationships with other countries with the aim of constraining the choices of other powers and providing room to Beijing. And this is very different from the United States' historical approach. Not that the United States is always perfect, but generally the international order that the United States has helped build and to lead is one that incentivizes countries to follow U.S. leadership because there are mutual interests served. But the authoritarian model that the Chinese Communist Party follows has led China to pursue this strategy of opportunism and specifically of offensive decoupling, in which Beijing aggressively eschews any type of foreign dependency for itself. Any entanglement while cultivating relationships with other countries that make those countries susceptible to Chinese tools of power, thereby enabling Beijing to more freely advance its own authoritarian agenda. So, with a tool like satellite navigation, China is not likely to ever follow the United States' example of openness and liberal cooperation. They may speak like that, but really the intent is to leverage those types of tools to strengthen the power and reach of the Chinese Communist Party by seeking to build that network of states that are more like vassals, not partners. And remember, too, that Beijing's ambition does not end with their own borders or with the Belt and Road Initiative members. Beijing aspires for China to supplant the United States as a global leader. So it has direct implications for the United States as well, and U.S. allies, and for U.S. goals in the world.
Yeah, and I'll also mention, you know, as you mentioned earlier on in the podcast about how much money that the GPS system generates for the U.S. economy and even the Western economy. If you think about it, all the tools that are GPS related, whether they be in the aviation sector, in your cars, banking industry, the gas pumps that everybody gets gas at, even if you're charging your electric car, all these things are interconnected with timing signals. And then, of course, we've had a lot of stuff in the news about navigation warfare with the Russians primarily and in Europe and other places that have been jamming signals that are impacting navigation of commercial airliners, which are putting, you know, hundreds of people at risk. And so with those types of situations and threats, I know the Chinese military is becoming more integrated with their satellites as they continue to launch more and more. And as you mentioned, it clearly is something that we should be taking seriously. If you were given the ability to recommend a way ahead for the next administration and Congress on this issue, what would you recommend? I mean, would it be an active counter debate now? Would we start to treat PNT as a key part of great power competition and not just a kind of a nice thing to have and a global utility that we just kind of look the other way? Or is there a more proactive approach? What's your thoughts on that? On a policy for fixing this issue?
Yeah, I have a couple thoughts on the policy front. I do feel that the United States needs a new, clearly articulated policy on GPS, viewing GPS not as a global utility or global commons so much, but as a tool of American national power. And not necessarily in an aggressive way, but just a willingness to acknowledge that this is an American system that we have provided to the benefit of other countries and particularly to our allies and partners, but that it is a tool that should serve U.S. interests. And U.S. policy on GPS really hasn't changed much in the last 20 years, but the international environment has. Mm-hmm. One thing the Trump administration actually realized was this need to start shifting GPS policy. So President Trump's 2020 space policy and 2021 space directive committed, like previous policies, to seeking compatibility with other global PNT providers. That was standard, but it emphasized that interoperability between those systems was going to be reserved for like-minded nations. And I think that was a step in the right direction. And of course, the Biden administration has really emphasized the importance of our allies and partners in deepening those relationships and strengthening those relationships as we see a rise of strategic adversaries in the world. So I think it's important for future administrations to continue that trend because the U.S. now needs a space power policy that facilitates not only cooperation with allies, but will also support effective competition with our adversaries.
Yeah, well, and I'll just add real quick, I'll just add this before I forget it, that I think maybe something else that I would like to see in addition to what you said, and I agree with what you're saying, is how do we try to counter or help the countries that may not have realized what they were getting themselves into before they got into this beta hostage situation, if you will, of, oh, you're stuck now. They have this agreement with these, you know, 100-year plus agreements. Which is kind of interesting that they're doing such things, given that's what some of the Western powers did with them, with like Hong Kong and things of that sort. So they're using similar tactics, I guess, that go back a ways. But I'm curious if you have any thoughts on how do we help people out of that situation, or is it just that we kind of let them go and try to, you know, help the folks who are like-minded and and things of that sort. You know, like, hey, I guess we're sorry about you guys getting sucked in, but we really can't help you. Or is it something that you want to actively try to help these folks out of BRI?
I agree with you. And I think it would be useful to provide alternatives to the Digital Silk Road. This is expensive. Obviously, it would take a lot of political commitment. There is already the Blue Dot Network and some more nascent initiatives to offer alternatives to Belt and Road Initiative investment and financing. Again, this is where we could really benefit from our like-minded allies. Think of the European Union, Japan, Australia, some key strategic partners like India. If we can pool our resources and provide alternatives to the Belt and Road Initiative, it may help some of the more vulnerable developing countries out of difficult situations they might find themselves in, and just complicate China's efforts overall to create a sphere of digital vassalage, because that's not good for any country. But also just thinking ahead long term, this is an area that needs more study. I think that there's some room here for Congress potentially to commission some studies from the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission, which is an excellent commission, and they put out excellent work, and they have looked at the Beidou system. Some they've looked at the Smart Cities Initiative. They put out a lot of good research, but I think there's an opportunity to dig a bit deeper. Looking at the potential conditions and impacts of this concept of offensive technological decoupling in anticipation of Beijing using Beidou coercively in the future.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but and this may be a topic I might do an episode on, is the more I read about the so-called smart cities and the more I see what our adversaries are doing, the more I think smart cities are dumb. they really, I understand that the whole idea of integration and efficiency, but I see a lot of, as a former military planner, I see a lot of danger, not just from the space, you know, signals standpoint, but also from the cyber side, which obviously I'm less familiar with, but I know enough about it to know that, hey, you know, if someone can come in and shut down all of your infrastructure, because everything is interconnected with these signals, then that's going to be a big issue, especially if a big, large conflict were to erupt. But that's a topic for another time. I really appreciate this discussion, Casey. If again, folks, if you haven't seen this, we'll try to post it on the podcast summary, if you will. And that way you can see the link to it with the National Institute for Public Policy's journal. It came out late last year, but it's still, I think, current as today's news obviously still relates to this, as this capability continues to expand on the Chinese side. So, Casey, again, I want to thank you for coming again. It's great talking with you, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Chris. I really appreciate the invitation. It's great talking with you.
Same here. Well, this is Christopher Stone with Real Space Strategy. Thanks very much for listening. Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Real Space Strategy. The Real Space Strategy edition is produced under NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, NIDS. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent on donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I want to thank our producer, Kimberly Sherrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.